All right, so I'm just gonna ask you some general questions about your experience in being a fish and or game warden.
Okay.
So I have to do this little intro first. So this is Christy Dentry, and I'm here with Jim Randall on Saturday, April 14th, 2012. We are at the Auburn Library, and this will be an oral history interview of Jim's experiences with the Department of Fish and Game. So, Jim, just tell me a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
Well, I grew up in Truckee, for the most part, Truckee and Lake Tahoe. I went to junior college in Santa Cruz County at Aptos at Cabrillo Junior College, mm-hmm. where I took a course that's no longer offered. It was only offered a short time in Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement. So I actually have a 2-year AA in Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement.
Oh, wow.
That's where I first got interested in working for Fish and Game.
Mm-hmm. Good. Did you grow up in Sacramento, or were
I grew up in Truckee. I spent my whole life, all through high school, in Truckee and Lake Tahoe. Mostly, I think I started at third grade in Truckee and then went all the way through high school and then into the Navy. And then I ended up in Santa Cruz. That's where my folks had moved by the time I got out of the Navy.
Where'd you serve in the Navy?
Mostly on the East Coast, out of Mayport, Florida, North Florida.
Okay. So, could you talk a little bit about the path that led you to a position of warden with Fish and Game?
Well, you know, initially, I didn't think I wanted to get into law enforcement. I was kind of kicking rocks, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life in Santa Cruz. I was working in construction, and although I enjoyed construction, I didn't think I wanted to do it forever. It's pretty much a cutthroat business, and so I started looking at the college catalog out at Cabrillo and saw this program called Fish and Wildlife Law Enforcement. And I've always been interested in the outdoors. I grew up hunting and fishing, so I took some of the introductory classes, and that led to meeting a bunch of fishing gamers, all except for a few of the core classes. It was all taught by not only fish and game wardens, but biologists. And that led to a position with Inland Fisheries, a seasonal position. And I just, from there, I started taking exams to get on full-time with Fish and Game.
Where is Inland Fisheries? Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, Inland Fisheries deals with inland waters as opposed to the marine environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of the Monterey office, in those days it was Region 3, forget what all the counties were, but we worked reservoirs, doing surveys, looking, you know, studying, you know, I assisted the biologists gathering info to study fisheries productivity and that kind of thing. And then we also did a little work with anadromous fisheries there for a while. I worked a trap at the top of a fish ladder at a little dam in Felton, mm-hmm. which is on the San Lorenzo River. So that was, I really enjoyed that. Initially, that's where I thought I wanted to be, was in fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, like today, it's not easy to get on with fishing game. So,
right.
You know, you get a foot in the door. And so I started taking exams as they came open. I took, I think the first exam I took was Fish and Wildlife Assistant 1, and that position you could work for any of the biologists or work in the hatcheries. In those days, the affirmative action was in its infancy,
mm-hmm.
and I was not randomly selected for an oral interview for that exam. Then the next one I took was for an entry-level position called Fish and Wildlife Conservation Aid. That was advertised as you could work for any branch of fishing game. Turned out everybody went to work for what was called the Wildlife Protection Branch.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I think it's Enforcement Branch. So it turned out that I after about 6 months of work in enforcement, I really enjoyed it.
So, could you describe the job of a fish and game warden for somebody that wouldn't really know? How would you explain to somebody that doesn't understand what it is?
Well, I think, you know, probably the big thing people don't understand is the wardens spend a lot of time working on habitat type issues rather than just catching some poacher someplace, some guy that's hunting or fishing without a license.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I worked, it was especially in eastern Placer County here, there was a lot of that type of work. It took up an inordinate amount of time compared to chasing poachers. But, you know, you got to be a self-starter. You work on your own for the most part and set your own schedule. I think they're still doing that. And you decide pretty much what you're going to do on a day-by-day basis. You know, and it's dictated by the various seasons. If hunting season's open, you go work hunters. If fishing season's open, you know, same thing.
Could you go back to the habitats? Are you building habitats or protecting
them?
No,
it's protecting habitat. There's several sections in the fish and game regulations that deal with habitat protection. One of them is the basic pollution section, and then the other one is a section that deals with protecting stream and the stream environment.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's involved in, you know, you dealt with everybody from miners to Caltrans, you know.
Right.
Every time somebody's building a road to cross a stream or working, you know, around a streamside environment, there's a procedure where they're supposed to notify Fish and Game, and then they get an agreement that allows them to incorporate Fish and Game's recommendations to protect the resources in their project.
Mm-hmm.
Just real time consuming. You know, logging industry, I worked with the loggers quite a bit at a particular timber sale. And they, now this one company was doing a lot of logging for about 5 years, but on a timber sale, they might have 15 or 20 stream crossings.
Mm.
So, you know, if you, unless you want to do them from your desk, it takes a lot of time to go
mm-hmm.
look at them, discuss the particulars of each one with the operator and try to keep, you know, let him do his project and then protect the resources at the same time.
Right. Could you describe the areas that you were responsible for?
Well, where I started in Kern County was, I think I figured once it was something like 1,800 square miles.
Wow.
That had farmland, everything from farmland to, you know, kind of arid sagebrush country to got into the southern end of the Sierra down there on the east side of the valley. I worked in southern Kern County for 6 years in a roving position. And then this up here, it's 180 different, you know, I think it was 800 or 900 square miles,
mm-hmm.
In elevation from about 3,000 feet to 7,000 or 8,000 feet, you know, from Auburn here all the way to the Sierra Crest, and you know, real steep canyons, a lot of cold water type fisheries, you know, all these trout streams and
right.
that kind of thing. So it's quite a bit different than the Valley District, but. The Valley Districts actually have more activity than the... So the other thing people don't understand, the wardens that work in the Valley, they can't turn around without finding something.
Right.
And where guys work in the Mountain Districts, you know, in the wintertime, you could go days without ever contacting somebody using the resources, you know.
Right.
It's a whole different deal.
So how are you expected to protect that large area?
That's always been the $64,000 question, you know. I mean, you just do the best you can. And, you know, when I started, Fish and Game was special fund agency, which they still are, although they're into the general fund a lot more than they were when I started.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm talking, I started in 79 full time, and they were about 75 or 80% funded by the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. Mm-hmm. Today, the percentage is a lot. And by the time I retired in 2004, the percentage was a lot lower. I think they're approaching a 50-50 split now. So
right.
There's never been enough money.
Mm-hmm.
I got real tired of hearing that as an excuse to the point where I just refused to accept it.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a lot, there's politics involved, and but by the time I retired, I was so frustrated that of not having the resources to really do the job, and that's everything from manpower to equipment. They've made a lot of improvements on the equipment side. The guys today, and even by the time I retired, the equipment end of things was really coming up. You know, I mean, game wardens today are probably the best armed peace officers in the state.
Right.
And a lot of good equipment, but the manpower issue is just the same, if not worse, today. And I don't know the answer to it, but better minds than mine have been working on it for a long time, you know. But,
so you talk about manpower. How many people did you have underneath you protecting that area?
Well, I was never in a supervisory position. And mm-hmm. my lieutenant squad, there was the lieutenant being the immediate supervisor. There was, I think, at any given time, depending on which squad I was in, there were three or four of us in that squad.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'd work with the adjoining warden, sometimes you wouldn't. Most of the time you didn't, because he had a big piece of country,
right,
too, you know. I mean, I think today there's still only about 300 field positions, roughly, for the whole state.
Wow.
You know, how many square miles in California?
Too many.
Yeah, I mean, it's no different anywhere else in the U.S. It's the same nationwide, I mean.
Right. Equipment-wise, what kind of equipment did you utilize, or what kind of equipment did you wish you had?
You know, in at one time in this district I had here in Placer County, what was then called the Forest Hill District, I had a four-wheel drive pickup, a 14-foot boat, you know, outboard motor, a snowmobile, a dual-purpose motorcycle, an on- and off-road type motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
That was a short period of time I had all of that, and the snowmobile was 100 years old. I mean, it was on its last legs, and after trying to get it replaced for years, I just gave up and would work with the U.S. Forest Service, which always seemed to have a little newer gizmos, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we would drive trucks that had 150,000 miles on them. And, you know, that's improved, but communications equipment could have been better. That's improved tremendously. There's still a wealth of surveillance equipment that's available. The technology today in surveillance equipment is amazing, and I don't know if the department's taken advantage or can afford it yet, you know.
Right.
But I used to work with the Forest Service a lot because they had that kind of stuff. I'd wait, you know, they'd be using all their remote cameras and sensing devices and this kind of thing trying to find marijuana growers, so I'd have to wait till the growing season was over, and then we'd put this stuff on a, you know, trying to catch some houndsman that was baiting bears, for instance, you know, and they put a bunch of attractants out there, which is illegal in California,
mm-hmm.
for hunting bears. And, you know, it can help some, but the wardens need every advantage they can get. I mean, everything. But probably manpower is a big issue. I mean,
right.
They could triple a force and still barely make a dent in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, it's like I say, sometimes, you know, sometimes in, I was too much for the whole area I was working. Other times, you take the middle of deer season, beginning of deer season, you could use 10 wardens in that in that country and not cover it all.
Right. I would imagine it's a lot like finding a needle in a haystack.
A lot of times. You work the percentages, you know, if nobody's fishing, you don't go work the reservoirs, you know.
Right.
Fishing season's going real good, and you work the fishermen. But there's it just depends on what you're trying to do. If you're just waving the flag, doing preventative work, mm-hmm. your goal is to contact as many people as possible and make sure everybody's, you know, you're just checking the basics, licenses and bag limits and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then if your goal is to catch the hard time poachers, and you know, the whole focus changes, where you becomes, you know, you're hardly contacting anybody. Maybe concentrating on trying to catch the hardcore guy that's cheating one way or the other, you know,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what it is, taking critters out of season or hunting at night, or there's just two, you know, more of an apprehensive type situation where you're concentrating on one group or one, maybe even just one individual that you've developed information on, and it's a hardcore poacher. And
how do you come across this information? Do you have informants? Do you make contacts?
Just routinely talking to people. Just depends on the individual. I know a lot of guys develop more hardcore informants, but a lot better than I was ever able to. Word of mouth gets around, you know, the honest hunters will hear something and they pass it along to you, so-and-so is up to this. You know, you start looking into it and discover, you know, there's probably something to what he's talking about, and then as time goes on, you learn more and more, you know, and mainly it's just talking to other people, talking to hunters and other law enforcement agencies, other government people. The Forest Service for me was always a wealth of information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a big job there was trying to educate them to what I educate the Forest Service employees to look for the same thing I'm looking for. And some guys could work with the Forest Service, and some guys didn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But out of Forest Hill on any given day, you know, there's a ranger district office there, and there'd be 12 or 15 Forest Service people running around in the woods in the same general area that I am in.
Right.
So just more eyes, and I always felt it was real worthwhile to cultivate those people a little bit, even though a lot of them didn't hunt or fish or knew, you know, exactly what I was looking for. And a lot of times they'd cry wolf, you know, think they were seeing a violation when they really weren't. But if you just kind of, you know, you could separate. I'd rather have them calling me crying wolf than not getting hold of me at all. That's right. The way I always looked at it.
More eyes out there.
Right. So that was always a big help. And like I say, just talking to people. And I think the only reason game wardens survive is they have a gift of gab.
Could you describe a typical day for me?
Well, you know, it's like, once again, depend on the time of year.
Say hunting season.
Say the opening day of deer season, for example. You would generally start early and head for the high country and start checking hunters as you came across them. You cover as much ground as you could, contact as many people as possible, check licenses, tags, make sure guys are hunting in the right zone, and check a lot of guns and vehicles, and make, you know, just enforcing safety regulations there. Make sure you can't have a loaded gun in a vehicle, for instance. And that's, you know, you work a long day if you could.
Mm-hmm.
If a lot of times the department's overtime restraints got in the way. So, you felt like you were kind of spinning the wheel sometimes, where something I saw change tremendously, had a big effect on what game wardens do, is when the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act went into effect as a result of some bus driver in Texas suing his agency, saying that FLSA applied to government agencies as well as industry. It had been enforced in industry for overtime rules for a long time, and the agency said, it doesn't apply to government agencies. Well, this guy in Texas took his agency to court, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they said, no, it applies to government agencies too. So it put a lot of restraints on wardens.
Right.
Because now the department has to worry about overtime situations. Our situation wasn't overtime until it was over 40 hours, which helped some. But I think there was always some problem worrying about whether that would change. So they, you know, all of a sudden, instead of just really being footloose and fancy free as far as what hours you work, it's like, okay, let's try to keep it under 8 and don't gain any overtime. All of a sudden, it was always comp time, you know, compensatory time off,
right,
instead of paid overtime. Mm-hmm. But it was hour for hour, so, and it was based on an 8-hour day when I started. So if you work 9 hours, you know, today, and then you keep track of your hours, and if you were done when you hit 40 hours, and as long as you didn't, you know, really abuse that, work, you know, 3 12s and a 4, take the rest of the week off, nobody cared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when they started having to compensate us at the rate of time and a half, then it becomes a time, okay, this guy's got to take this time off at some point. So that takes them out of the field. So they've started putting ceilings on how much of this comp time you could carry, and worrying about how you, when you gained it. And,
right.
And it drove us all nuts. You know, you got to understand that there's nothing game wardens would rather do than go out and try and catch somebody. And I mean, that was one of the beauties of the job. It's like, where else can you find a job that where you can't wait to get up and go to work? You know, you go,
mm-hmm,
you know, damn, I got to go home. You know, I can't keep going all night because,
right,
you know, we used to say, well, the one good thing was the day started over at midnight.
Oh.
So you could work that angle a little bit, you know.
Start really early.
Yeah. But, I don't know, I forgot where we were going with this. But a day in the life of a game warden, it could vary anything from, like, real busy on opening day of deer season, where you check 100 people maybe, to, you know, before the hunting seasons are open in the summertime, checking fishermen. And
mm-hmm,
in this country, I worked 3 or 4 different reservoirs with this small boat. I'd putt around, check fishermen, work in a semi out of uniform mode, where I just put a shirt over my uniform and,
right,
look like a fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
And in those kind of situations, a lot of times I'd run around, check licenses, and then if I saw somebody that I thought might be trying to take an over limit, or you know, up to no good, saying, oh, I'm not fishing, the kids are fishing, then sit back and watch them look like a fisherman.
Mm-hmm.
And I always enjoyed that quite a bit. I liked working fishermen. A lot of fun. The whole job was, like I say, it was hard not to like it, you know what I mean?
Right.
There were times when there were efforts being made by the wardens to change things that I fought tooth and nail. One of those being the working out of your house. I mean, hello, what's not to like, you know? You work out of your house, set your own schedule, you know, you've got from a minute after midnight, you know, to midnight to put in 8 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that.
Yeah, I mean, and guys wanted to change that at one point, you know. They said, they felt they weren't getting compensated properly for maintain an office in their house or something. I don't know. I forget the issue, but there were 4 or 5 years that was a hot button topic.
Mm-hmm.
I still talk to a couple of the wardens, and it doesn't seem to be such an issue anymore. There's been a lot of changes. You know, I saw a lot of changes. There's wardens around it that are, you know, started way before I am. They're still around. There's the guy I replaced in Forest Hill is still on the green side of the grass. He's 85 or 86 years old, and
wow,
he really saw changes. You know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Could you tell me about some of your most unusual experiences, or some of your most memorable?
There's a lot of them, you know.
Pick a good, juicy one.
Well, probably one of the most exciting cases. I was relatively new and in Kern County, and it was the opening day of band-tailed pigeon season, which is, you know, a wild pigeon that's still hunted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd got up out of I was going to go work in the Glenville area, which is in the on the west slope of the foothills. Pigeons came in this country, and I got kind of an early start, and I don't know, not real early, and talking to these pigeon hunters, and they were saying, hey, what are these houndsmen doing? We heard these dogs barking, and houndsmen have always been one of game warden's favorite customers, or most of them generate a lot of interest, you know, because they earned a reputation of cheating.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I don't know what these guys are doing. I was barely on my own, you know, I barely to the point where they turned me loose working on my own. And I finally came across the guy's truck. And you can tell most houndsmen's trucks are real obvious. They have these crates, boxes in the back with it. You know, they have a whole pack of dogs where they put the dogs in the dog boxes, and he's parked alongside this road, and nobody around. So I kind of went on about my business, thinking about this guy, and I wonder what he could be up to. And at lunchtime, I went back down in the little town of Glenville, got a hamburger, and I could hardly eat the hamburger for thinking I should be sitting on that truck.
Mm-hmm.
I wait for him to come back, so I can see what he's up to. So I shove the hamburger down my throat and run back up the hill, and the truck's coming down the hill. And at this point, I had a brand new vehicle, which is something they used to do. They'd go, here's your truck, and you'd go drive it around. It wouldn't even have any of the equipment in it yet. You know? No red lights, no nothing. See? Well, that's the situation I was in. I see this truck coming towards me. So I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to stop this guy so I can check him. There's no problem with probable cause to stop him. You know, I know I've got all this information that he's been hunting. He's seen the dog boxes, you know, and people, you know, knew half a dozen reports of people hearing the dogs. And
mm-hmm.
So I end up leaning out the window and trying to have as much of my uniform visible as possible, asking a guy to pull over or to stop, and he stops. You know, we stop in the middle of the road. It's a, you know, a country road. It's not like stopping on I-80 someplace. And I ask him if he'd go down and pull off, you know, the first wide place. I wanted to talk to him. Oh, okay. So I go back, and, you know, I get turned around, and sure enough, the guy pulled off, fortunately. And, you know, no red lights, no nothing.
Right. See? And
so I stop, and you know, ask him what he's up to. Oh, you know, just out here. I think he had an excuse. It seems like he could have been bear hunting. I think bear season was open.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, he could be out there with his dogs hunting bears. And if had any luck? Oh, no, we haven't had any luck. And I could see either red paint or barn stain on his boots. His clothes are brand clean. Nothing on them. And there's, you know, there's dogs in the boxes, there's a bunch of other gear and plastic bags, and one old dog is just loose in the back of the truck. So I thought, well, he probably doesn't have anything in the back of the truck. That dog would be into it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a crew cab pickup. And there's two teenage girls in the back seat.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's a big plastic bag in between them. So I'd ask the guy, do you have any, you know, the standard routine questions I'd been taught by the old farts that trained me, you know, have any birds or animals in the truck? No. Do you mind if I take a look? Oh, no, go ahead. So I'm kind of working my way around the truck, trying to decide where, you know, where to really get looking. And like I say, with this one dog in the back, I kind of put a low priority on all this gear in the back of the truck. And I'm kind of move a couple of these plastic bags around. Oh, that's just camping gear, you know, what's in here? And I get around to the passenger side and I reach across one of these gals where this big plastic bag is. And I cannot lift this bag with my arm straight out. There's mm-hmm. something heavy in that. And so I ask her to step out. And she gets out, no arguments or anything. I give her a hand and I get inside this bag. And the guy, about the time I'm in this bag and I come up with a lion paw on its hide, he says, oh, can you just search my truck? And I said, yeah, especially when you give me permission.
Right.
And, you know, he said, well, I don't give you permission. And, well, I'm so new, I stop and think, oh, I'm like, once he's given me permission, can he rescind it? I think he can, but I think I'm okay because I already found, now I've got probable cause to search the whole truck, because before he said anything, I got contraband, see?
Right.
So anyway, this guy had killed a mountain lion, and lions were protected then, like they are today. They just, it had been a while, I guess, since they got special. They didn't have the protection they do today, but there was a moratorium on hunting them. Mm-hmm. And it turned out this guy was real active in the Houndsman's Association. So that case went on and on. My captain almost had a heart attack when he heard, he was so happy to hear about, when he heard who it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we used to kind of brag on the radio, if you did it right, you could do it without, like, sounding like you were really bragging, you know. And everybody in the country know what you were up to. So I played the dumb new guy and called one of the other wardens up at, I was close to Lake Isabella. And in fact, I still email this guy. I said, hey, I seized a lion hide. How do I take care of it? And, you know. So the word, by the time I got back to town, the captain only lived about 3 or 4 blocks from me. But I stopped by his house, and he'd already heard about it, of course, because it's the whole country, you know, on the radio. Nobody even had cell phones in those days, but still it would,
right.
Word traveled fast. And he was overjoyed to hear this guy's name, because he'd been a thorn in the captain's side complaining about being mistreated by game wardens. And
So you caught the right guy.
Yeah.
With the right contraband.
And it turned out he was a real lowlife. Turned out he was a pervert. He was molesting his daughters.
Mm.
But that's how it goes on and on with that. So, that was an exciting case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, brand new and come up with something like that. I think I was on maybe 2 years then, maybe a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 2 years, because I was working on my own then. But then working the Southeast Asians was real interesting over the years. Real interesting. I saw, you know, as a result of the whole Vietnam conflict and all of that, these people of different, they're not all Vietnamese, they're different, actually more like tribes, people that came from Cambodia and Laos and the highlands between North and South Vietnam, ended up in, because they were helping the United States when their involvement was over there, they ended up in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you've heard of the Hmong people and Montagnards and Hmong, H-M-O-N-G. And,
mm-hmm.
Well, these people in their country are basically a hunter-gatherer society.
Right.
And they come over here, and this is the land of plenty, and they start off doing the same thing. And I saw the whole influx of these people from when you never would, you know, all of a sudden you're finding these guys where, you know, the year before you never saw, you'd never heard of them.
Right.
So when I ended up here, they were a big part of my patrol in the fall. And they were real interesting to work. Interesting people. They were amazing hunters. They would put in time and effort above and beyond what any other class people ever worked to try and harvest a gray squirrel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also real good at, they cheat like crazy. Some, you know, 10% of them were 10% of them were crooked, like, you know, 10% of the general population of Forest Hills poaches.
Right.
But these guys are just way better at it than your average 10%, you know, your average, I mean, people are determined, you know. They're interesting, find boned out deer and stashed in cars and all kinds of stuff. One point, my lieutenant told me he was going to buy me a creeper. You know, the creeper,
what's
like
that?
Mechanic works, the slide underneath cars.
Oh.
I found contraband on top of spare tires. Mm-hmm. Under, you know, spare tire, most pickups are stored up underneath the rear of the bed.
Oh.
Found a bunch of songbirds and a hawk and on top of the spare tire ones. And, I don't know. Had some interesting cases with bear hunters where a lot of effort went into trying to catch them.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, they were baiting. But you don't realize what, you know, I mean, a lot of times it doesn't seem like it's a noteworthy case or anything till later you get thinking about it and go, oh, that was kind of unusual, you know.
Right. But what do you think your biggest fear on the job was, if anything?
Oh, I don't know. Probably having a wreck. Probably driving a truck off a cliff someplace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never felt that threatened by even the hardcore bad guys. Maybe that was a mistake on my part, you know, but I never felt that threatened by the people I was working. I know a lot of, you talk to other law enforcement, you know, deputies or city cops, and time and time again, I heard, well, you're nuts, I wouldn't have your job. Everybody you talk to has a gun. But game wardens work different, you know, than city cops. And 99% of the time, we knew what we were getting into before we got into it, because you'd sit back and watch and try to figure out what these people are up to. Where, you know, some street cop down here, he gets a call, there's a fight at, you know, Joe Blow's address. You don't know mm-hmm. what the hell he's going to run into.
Right.
But, on the other hand, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has kept statistics on game warden assaults for years, and their statistics show that the assault rate on game warden types nationwide is way higher than it is on other law enforcement.
Wow.
So there's no doubt it's a dangerous job. I don't know. I think the way I was trained is a lot different than the way wardens are being trained today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some of the policies the department's using today makes the guys' jobs more dangerous because of the attitude they've instilled in them, you know, where to be overly suspicious. I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't be careful or be suspicious, but
right.
on the other hand, they shouldn't. They don't need to treat everybody like they're a criminal, you know. And by taking real staunch, strict approaches, I think is dangerous. Where you get people mad when there's no need to, you know. It's the old adage, catch more flies with honey than you know.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, when I started, the department had no field training officer program. They weren't even doing defensive tactics, you know, which is, you know, arm twisting and batons
right.
and They weren't even doing it. They weren't even doing that training. That training started after I did.
Wow.
You know, they would issue batons, but I'm probably talking loud. I forgot my hearing aids.
No, you're good.
But I just realized I forgot them again. A relatively new thing. But, you know, I was old fart trained. You know, I went through the Peace Officers Academy in Kern County. And then they said, you go ride with this guy, you go ride with that guy. It's his days off, we'll ride with somebody else, you know. And those guys just, you know, all these guys had, how much time. You know, I was trying to, you know, they'd all been on probably 15, 20 years by the time I started. Almost the whole captain's district was three lieutenant's districts down there, you know, so roughly 12 or 14 wardens, and all of them are old timers like this, and they, mm-hmm. and you kind of paid attention to how they did the job, and the first thing you notice is they treated everybody real nice.
Right.
And they got some horrendous bad guys, see. And, you know, one guy I worked with quite a bit, I started noticing that we'd go catch these guys and then maybe we worked a lot of rabbit hunters. They'd have a big over limit or something, and we'd write tickets like, he'll have no tomorrow, and the guys would end up thanking you.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Wow.
When you left, see? And you go, that's how you want to do the job, if you can get these guys to thank you. After you finished up a big ticket, then, you know. So I always, you know, for the most part, I mean, there were times, and I'm not saying I never made anybody mad. I know there were times I did when I would forget that and start treating people differently. And it almost always just about bit me in the ass
mm-hmm.
when you start getting real hard-nosed with people. You're always better off to try and just stay real friendly and go home at night, you know.
Right. How has the wildlife or the environment in your jurisdiction changed during your time with Department of Fish and Game?
Oh, that country hasn't changed tremendously. You know, I saw a lot of logging take place, and I saw some huge, two big forest fires that did more to change the environment than anything.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular went, I think, 70,000 acres.
Wow.
But,
was that in Kern County?
No, this was up here. What is the name of that fire? It burned up around, started below French Meadows Reservoir and went clear up above it, but, I don't know. This district I worked with 90% Forest Service land, you know, most which changes a lot slower than some of the more urban environments.
Right.
So I didn't see a lot of change as far as, you know, species composition or the habitat, or, you know, most of the logging was done pretty responsibly. There were some, you know, you couldn't stop all the clear cuts, but
right.
But even there, that, you know, I mean, a lot of it was selectively logged, so within 3 or 4 years on the selectively logged stuff, it wouldn't even very obvious it had been logged. But the fires really changed it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's probably made deer in particular more vulnerable because they're more visible.
Right.
But that can improve their habitat too. So, I don't think it's really changed all that much. It's still pretty much, you know, what was there when I started is still there.
Right. Okay. Would you consider yourself an environmentalist or a conservationist?
Conservationist, for sure. You know, in my definition of conservation, it's the wise use of resources, not non-use or the preservation of the resources. I mean, you know, you can use the resources and still have something for future generations if it's done responsibly. Right. And that goes for, I don't care, you know, what resource you're talking about. Everything from hunting and fishing to the consumptive uses of like logging or mining or any of that.
Right.
You know, you can, it can be done and still protect the resources. I mean, money gets in the way with the consumptive uses. I bumped heads with miners, I bumped heads with loggers, and one of the best things I ever heard upper management say was with this logging company. I had a logging company come in and buy 30,000 acres of timberland in my district and start logging the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. And that, this was, you know, it wasn't like it was virgin timberland. It had been logged by the previous owner. Now it was just getting back, you know, 50 years, 60 years earlier, had been logged by the previous owner. And so these guys were taking virtually every marketable stick they could find off of it. And
wow.
We were bumping heads over trying to protect the resources. And they ended up, we ended up in a big meeting down at the regional office. And it was quite the dog and pony show initially, you know. Higher mucky mucks of this company, a big company, you know, they're all over California. They came in, and of course all the regional managers and environmental services managers and as field people weren't even invited till I got wind of it and said, hey, I think maybe we should be there, you know.
Right. I've got something to say.
They agreed with me, but you know, after sitting there for 20-30 minutes listening to a big spiel on the history of this company, they got down to what their problem was, and that was with the care they were having to take in crossing these streams. And it wasn't my idea. You know, I'm passing on what the recommendations I'm getting from the environmental services and the biologists at the regional level. I mean, they had procedures on how to do this. You know, I didn't invent this section, although I was behind it a lot more than some of the other wardens.
Right.
I actually knew a warden that was responsible for coming up with this particular section, or helped come up with it. But they finally got down to brass tacks and started complaining about how much it cost them to protect every little intermittent stream. And the regional manager, who was a little short guy named Jim Messersmith, he's long since retired. And in those days, the chain of command was a lot different than it is now. Nowadays, the wardens don't even report to the regional manager. It stays in law enforcement, the law enforcement chain of command, instead of going. The regional manager in those days not only supervised all, ultimately, law enforcement, but all the biological functions, too.
Oh.
But these guys start whining about how much it's costing them and yada, yada. And he looks at them and says, gentlemen, when it comes to making... he said, gentlemen, we don't consider economics when we make recommendations to protect the resources. I could have kissed the guy, you know. And that was the, you know, that was the end of the discussion.
Right.
And it was pretty much the end of my hassles with these guys. I got a lot easier to get along with. And that was an issue where this region, they came down to their, in Northern California, which in those days was Region 1, and they were had been doing business different up there. And they come down here, and it appeared to me that Region 2 was making their life more restrictive, you know, which is, you can, if you look at it from there, that shouldn't have been the case.
Right.
It's the state of California. It should have been the same from one end of the state to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always the same. Probably isn't today.
Right. So how do you think that your career influenced your life? What did you take away from being a Department of Fish and Game warden?
You should ask my wife that one, you know. Oh, I don't know. Being a game warden is your life, you know. I mean, there's no way around it. That's one of the disadvantages to working out of your house. I mean, it is your life, and it's your family's life. And, you know, in my case, it's just myself and my wife. But you know, you work in these small towns, and pretty soon everybody knows who you are. You know, who she is. And, you know, there were certain places where she'd get asked fish and game questions every time she went uptown, you know, which she got kind of sick of. But, and, you know, phone ringing all kinds of middle of the night, and even though it was a separate phone. Prior to, you know, there's a lot of people couldn't believe that, you know. A lot of guys had one phone line. I was that way for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't know how it really influenced my outlook overall. I mean, I think I was into conservation and the outdoors before I went to work for Fish and Game, and
mm-hmm.
that pretty much stayed the same. Probably made me a lot more politically aware than before I started, you know. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I became more conservative over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more realistic outlook, you know. I mean, probably when I started, I was more of a preservationist than when I finished. You know, just leave it alone. And that, it I don't know how else to put it other than being a game warden is a way of life. It's more than a job. It's a full-time job, 24/7. I mean, it becomes next impossible to get away from it.
Right.
You leave the state, you know. even then, game wardens, I think is the same today. They're deputy U.S. wardens. There's, what is it, 7 or 8 federal acts have to do with wildlife that you can enforce anywhere in the United States.
Oh, wow.
And in California, forget it. You're on, you know, you could take action on fish and game issues anywhere in the state. I hate to tell you how many times the wife and I are off on vacation and, you know, she would bring it up. You know, well, you're gonna do something, aren't you? You know, I mean, so it's, and I don't know how much of that is still the case today, but I know, talking that I've heard stories of other wardens running into the same thing. You know, I mean,
right.
Driving down the highway, I mean, one time up north of Susanville, we're coming back from Oregon, we're driving down 395 north of Susanville, and right alongside us, some guy standing up in the back of a pickup shooting at doves on this farmland, you know. And we're going, what the hell, you know. My wife says, well, you're going to do something, aren't you? You know, so you try. I think that day I came across, I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere. No cell phone in those days. We didn't have one. I didn't have a cell phone until 3 years ago, you know, but
mm-hmm.
One of the last people to break down and get one. But I think I finally came across a highway patrolman in a stop, and I pulled over and introduced myself, and I don't know if anybody ever got caught, but that happened. I don't know, it seemed like every time you went someplace, you know, looking back on it, but it wasn't. There were a lot of times, you know. I probably hunted less when I was working than I do now, for sure, because I couldn't, especially deer hunting. I always bought a tag and license, but I wouldn't go. I'd only go 2 or 3 times a whole season, because every time I went deer hunting, I ended up going to work. You know?
Right.
And
makes sense. Would you recommend your career path to someone today?
Yeah. Even today, it's still an excellent job. You know, I mean, I saw changes that I didn't like. The guys that were on when I came on really saw changes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But and that's, you know, that's going to continue. But it's still an amazing job, and you know, we're back to what I said earlier. I just, you know, what's not to like? You set your own hours, work out of your house. I mean, come on, you know, tell me where you can find another job like that.
Right.
And you know, there's, you never get rich doing it. I could have stayed in the construction industry and maybe made more money, but you know, there's always talk there too. Oh, they're going to get the same money Highway Patrol does. I've heard that my whole career. But maybe someday that'll happen. You know, I mean, it should. Game wardens are, you know, their educational backgrounds, that's the highest requirements of any peace officer class in the state. Mm-hmm. So, well, park rangers, state park rangers, are, they need a bachelor's. But there's a pay disparity between the wardens and some of the other, almost any other law enforcement agency. And so I don't know, I would recommend it today to anybody that's really interested in it. They, you know, I would say, you know, look into it, make sure you know what you're getting into. Don't become a game warden if you're just looking for a job.
Right.
You know, you got to have some interest in what you're doing, or you're just, you know, I don't think you would stay there. Mm-hmm. I saw a few people that actually quit. And that was, when I started, that was unheard of. Mm-hmm. The only way a position ever opened up was somebody retired or died.
Wow.
And now, today, you know, during my career, I saw guys come on and then you'd hear, oh, he quit, went to work for so-and-so, you know, went another law enforcement agency usually.
Right.
And almost always another law enforcement agency. Oh, you know, he got on with the deputies, you know, sheriff's department. That was unheard of when I started. I mean, that was one of the reasons it was so tough to get on, is nobody left.
Right.
And that's still, you know, it's changed a little bit. I mean, there are people now that are just looking for a law enforcement job, and so they think, oh, that would be cool. And then they realize it's, when they don't have any backup, it's not so cool, you know. But,
right.
I'd still recommend it, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll wrap up there.
Okay.
I'm all out of questions, but thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.